Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. Today I have a very special guest, Mala Cunningham. We've had Mala on the show before, and she's always a favorite. Today she's going to talk about the eight-limb path of yoga, as outlined by Patanjali, and tie that into neuroscience and psychology. So it's a really incredible conversation that we have. If you're kind of a science nerd, you're going to really love this. And if you're into mental health, it will especially be right up your alley. So let's go meet Mala and get started. Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. My name is Amy Wheeler. This is season 10. We've been here about 3 years together on the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast, and now we want to go deeper. This year, we'll be studying the eight limbs of yoga, and we really hope you enjoy the depth of this season. Welcome, Mala. So nice to see you this morning. How are you?
I'm doing really well, and I'm excited to be here and talk with you about these important concepts of neuroscience, yoga, and psychology.
Yeah, we are so excited to talk to you. I think our audience is really going to love all that you're going to provide us with today. So let's just jump right in. I know we have about 40 minutes or so with you, and I want to make the most of every single moment. So the eight-limb path of yoga, do you think we can view it through a clinical lens?
What a great question. And absolutely. I've been interfacing the Yoga Eightfold Path in my clinical practice for, gosh, over 35 years. And I developed a model, the neuroscience yoga psychology model. Neuro yoga psychology model is the abbreviated form. And all of the steps in the Eightfold Path correlate with something related to healing, really important interventions for cognitive and emotional regulation and physical healing. And those eight steps correlate, and that's what my model is about. It correlates with aspects of modern psychology, and it's substantiated by neuroscience and by all the research that has come out over the last 20 to 30 years. And then we look at outcomes. What are the outcomes we're looking at based on these steps in the Eightfold Path? And honestly, I think when Patanjali codified the Yoga Sutras and implemented this Eightfold Path concept, I mean, it was just brilliant because he moved from cognitive and behavioral concepts and ethical and moral guidelines. And he moved from the mind and the emotions to the body, to the breathing, to basically mindset training in the last four steps. How do you train the brain to go internal, to focus, and to allow a meditative state to emerge?
Yeah, I love what you just said. So I've got to kind of break it down. I've seen a magnificent chart that you created that had each of the eight limbs. We'll just say the social disciplines, the personal disciplines, the postures, the breath work, the turning the senses inward, and then different states of meditation, the last three. So you've got the eight limbs in a column, and then you go through and you talk about, in psychology, here are some correlates to those eight limbs. And then here's the neuroscience, or here's the outcomes that we already know work. So, I mean, just in that one chart that I saw, I think it was a year ago, like there was so much information just showing that we pretty much already have the research for each of the eight steps to show that it works.
Exactly. Absolutely. And that's what I was saying, is that the way Patanjali codified this concept, to have thought about that way back in the second century or so, the CBE, it's like, how brilliant was that, that it would still be relevant and very important to contemporary society. And to then take it further with the advent of new technologies such as the fMRI and the qEEG and things like that, where we're able to see more clearly into the brain, what parts of the brain are lighting up and things like that, we're able to substantiate that these ancient practices actually work. And this is what's happening in the brain, so that we know that they're actually making a difference.
Well, let's jump into kind of the neuroscience of it all.
Okay.
And let's talk about Patanjali's eight limb path. I think it has both top-down models where you're working with your mind and your mindset, or like you said, CBT, yoga philosophy. So there's the top-down, but then there's the bottom-up. There's how do you change your physiology? How do you change your state from an embodied sense to impact how your mind is thinking? So could you walk us through, are there certain parts of the eight-limb path that you might consider top-down versus bottom-up?
Absolutely. So the yamas and niyamas, the cognitive and behavioral guidelines, are really pretty much top down. They're mental and emotional practices, emotional regulation practices, cognitive regulation practices, cognitive revamping, thought stopping, correlate with things like pratibhaksha bhavana in the yoga world. And so those are top-down concepts of basically mindset training, you know, and mindset training is not as well known in the yoga circles as it is in psychology circles. But Carol Dweck, who's a psychologist at Stanford, basically formatted mindset training, and it's a brilliant concept. She talks about a fixed mindset, you know, where someone sees failure as a judgment, or their abilities are static, or they avoid challenges to protect themselves. That's kind of a fixed mindset where a person is not able to have emotional flexibility or cognitive flexibility, versus a growth mindset where a person embraces challenges, or they see failure as basically information for learning and change and growth. So the concepts in psychology, it just so brilliantly merges with the ancient teachings of yoga. So the top-down concepts really are more about cognitive behavioral therapy, emotional intelligence, mindset training, positive psychology. The bottom-up interventions are also very, very important. It's learning the skill set to bring our awareness into the sensations and the nudges, and moving our consciousness towards embodiment. I worked for probably decades with heart patients, and one of the things that I became aware of is that because they felt like their body had turned on them in some way through having a heart attack or high blood pressure or whatever, many times they lived from the neck up and out. They didn't have any sense of embodiment or the signals that their body was giving them. So one of the things that I emphasized in the cardiac medical yoga program, the teacher training program, is how to help patients become more embodied, become more aware of the nudges and the signals that their body was telling them, because that is just invaluable information about healing and how we can begin to de-stress our system. When we de-stress the system, right there is the start of healing.
It's such an amazing thing you've just said. And I see it kind of like the chicken or the egg, right? That once we get pretty ill, I don't think it's just cardiac patients. I think it's...
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Then we stop feeling, but feeling is what we need to do in order to have healing. And so somehow we have to break into that cycle and start to feel in a more somatic way again. We have to feel, oh, I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, or I'm full, or I have to go to the bathroom, or it hurts when I lift my arm, or gosh, my heart hurts emotionally, or, you know, we have to feel feeling again in order to get them on the way to healing, I guess.
On their journey, exactly. And it's really important with patients who have a medical condition to start with really, really simple awareness and insight techniques. So in other words, it's really important to not go to necessarily, what are you feeling in your body? It's more important in those tender beginning stages to help them to understand signaling around hunger. Is there pain somewhere or discomfort? You don't really want to use the word pain, but discomfort is a better word. Is there discomfort somewhere that you're feeling in your system? Are you holding stress in your eyes, your jaw, your shoulders? It's a safer journey to start with simple physical awareness signaling versus emotional signaling that happens in our system. You know, so the journey is important in terms of the step-by-step process.
Can I ask how you do that? Because if someone has chronic pain and they've kind of just shut down all the signals, positive and negative, or I know people who have neurodivergence, a lot of times the signals of hunger or thirst maybe aren't as strong or prominent. There's other reasons why, maybe some trauma cases where we're feeling disassociated. So how do you first get people to start feeling those signals of hunger or thirst, or I'm hot or I'm cold, or oh, my back hurts? Like, how do you get them to start feeling again?
Sure. And that's an excellent question. Now, I will say this, that I'm going to put emotional trauma in a separate category, because that's a whole nother angle and interventional process that is different. It's a little different. So in general, some of the things that I do, I'll just give you some examples. So we might do something as simple as have some raisins on the table and pick up a raisin, feel it with your eyes closed, get a sensation of what that feels like. What is the kinesthetic feeling of the raisin?
Feeling the raisin on your fingers.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And then putting it in your mouth and not necessarily chewing it right away, but what are the sensations? Chewing it, what are the sensations? What is the taste that's beginning to form? You swallow it. How does that feel to swallow it and follow it down into your stomach? So those are some ways to begin somatic awareness. Now, you can also do this by drinking a glass of water and just having people take a sip of water and feeling the sensations of the water in your mouth. Just basically, we're slowing everything down and bringing our consciousness to what is. Other ways that I've done this is we can take our fingertips, or we can take a feather and just very gently have it on your palm or on your forearm. And how does that feel? Some people love the sensation because it's very calming to the nervous system. Other people, it kind of tickles. So there's no right or wrong. There's just curiosity about how you feel and what's happening with your system at that moment. Another technique that I'll use is I'll have people identify three things in the room, just three objects or a dot on the wall or a picture, whatever it might be, and linger for a few seconds on one object or dot or a spot on the floor, and then go to the next, linger, go to the third, linger, and then close your eyes and bring those three objects into your mind's eye. You see? And just allow and be aware once you open your eyes after we do external and internal, how does your body feel now? Do you feel more calm? Do you feel more relaxed? Because typically that will activate a relaxation response. So there's all sorts of entry ways that are considered emotionally safe and not challenging or slamming into the system that is beyond the person's capability.
I love all of these, and they are so subtle and gentle. And like you said, slow down so you can really experience it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever do anything more physical, like with, you know, arm lifting and lowering or bending to one side or anything like that?
Absolutely. One of the things that I do, actually in a lot of my medical yoga classes or even my regular yoga classes, one of the things that I do in the very first class is I have everybody put their arm out straight and then take their hand and pull their hand in. So they're stretching the forearm, and I have them do that to the point of discomfort. I'll say to the whole class, is everybody at a point of discomfort? And they usually say, yes, it's uncomfortable. And I say to them, great, don't do that during our yoga class. Now you have a kinesthetic marker that tells you when something is not right, when it's no longer a feel-good stretch. So now you have a marker what to do and what not to do, because what we're aiming for, obviously, is a feel-good stretch. So yes, there are many of those things that we sort of build up to in terms of somatic movements and inner awareness and things like that.
All right. So we've kind of covered how beautifully the eight limbs of yoga naturally map onto both top-down strategies of mindset training, if you will, and bottom-up strategies of learning to feel again. So there's so many things that you do that I find interesting. They're just very different than most people. You also use your model, the neuro yoga psychology model, things like helping maybe even like business people to build emotional intelligence, or a teacher, or, you know, whoever. So can you talk a little bit about how the model lends itself to building emotional intelligence?
Yes. Well, everything honestly in the model is built around mindset training. I mean, that's the whole yoga platform. If we were to just narrow it down, if we think about an inverted pyramid, we have a lot of information at the top of the inverted pyramid. And as we narrow down and make sense of the yoga teachings relevant to our personal life, because we have to personalize these practices and have them be relevant to our particular life and how we navigate life. So once we narrow down that this is what I need, this is what my practice is going to look like, the eight limbs cover mental, emotional, spiritual, physical reset, how to reset. That's what it's designed for. Now, we can't necessarily go into businesses and use Sanskrit and conceptualize the teachings. We have to conceptualize the teachings so that it is acceptable to the Western mind, to the business mindset, without losing the essence of the teachings. So across all concepts, whether you're talking about mindfulness, mindset training, positive psychology, or yoga, there are common themes across all of those disciplines. So awareness is high at the top of a common theme that runs across. Insight, connection, purpose. All of those come out of the yogic tradition, but they're not just part of the yoga tradition. They're part of common sense. They're part of how do we navigate life. They're part of psychology, but they're also and should be a part of the business sector. So whether you're in business or healthcare or any other area, academia, the government, the military, we need to more expansively, and it's happening, bring these concepts into human flourishing and what it means to thrive and flourish and be embodied and have a platform that we can operate from that is our value system.
Let's take just a little pause here to talk about our Ayurveda Practitioner Certificate at Notre Dame of Maryland School of Integrative Health. This Ayurvedic certificate program is 4 classes. It's 12 credits. It is an accredited university with federal financial aid available. We also accept the GI Bill. We would love for you to come on over and get a little bit of Ayurvedic expertise, especially if you're already a yoga teacher or a yoga therapist. If you'd like more information about our Ayurvedic certificate program, we do have open houses at Notre Dame of Maryland once a month, or you can email me and I can send you all the information. We hope you'll consider joining us for the Ayurvedic certificate program. All right, let's get back to the episode.
You know, Mala, I see you living these teachings. I see how you have trained your mind probably, I don't know, 40, 50 years. I'm not sure how long, but
about that.
And I want to be that person. I want the person who's seeing the good, the compassion, the sweetness, the joy, the purpose. And then there's this little voice, and I don't know whose voice it is, but don't spiritually bypass, don't, you know, look at the good. So what would you say to that little voice who's like, wants to be heard, that we can't just mindset our way into a spiritual bypass? And I know that's not what you're doing, but I want to hear your words of what your answer is to that.
The concept of spiritual bypassing is a good one for dialogue and for conference themes, I think, because it so easily happens that we justify certain things happening in our life or certain decisions. We justify it as it's God's design for us or whatever, however we spiritually bypass. And I'm not saying that those things may not be true. They may be that it's God's design. But each individual person really has to take a look at what they need to take responsibility for, how they can deepen their insight, because awareness and insight are two different things. They overlap a little bit, of course, but they're two different things. And we have to be very careful to drop as deeply as we can into satya, truthfulness, and be brutally honest with our identifying what our defense mechanisms are, where we're barricaded due to the need to feel emotionally safe or not attacked in some form or another. So what this gets to, Amy, honestly, is I think all of us, no matter who we are, we all need guides or coaches or therapists. Some people turn to gurus. Whatever a person's individual choice is, we all need inspiration and guidance occasionally on our path so that we can course correct, so that we can not spiritually bypass, so that we can be held accountable for what's happening and what our responsibility is in any particular issue.
I love your answer. I have a whole nother answer. Can I share it with you?
I would love that. Yeah, because this is a broad topic for sure.
We could just, you know, keep it tight and move on. But
yeah,
I've thought so much about this, is that it's hella hard to keep my heart open, my mind clean and pure, to stop the negative, destructive thoughts, the nastiness, the darkness in my mind. Like, there's no spiritual bypass going on. It's like a full-time job to clear and clean and come back to present moment and be with what's real and not jacked. Like, I don't know what spiritual bypassing is, because it's just hard enough to like try to stay clean and not too toxic and mean or nasty, you know? Like, I think that's hard for a lot of people, not to get just dragged down by the difficulty of life.
I think you're absolutely right. And the good news is, here's the good news. Here's the exciting part. And this is what I'm passionate about. When we do certain practices, yogic practices and interventions to regulate the vagus nerve, what we're doing in regulating the parasympathetic nervous system, the vagus nerve makes up 70 or 80% of the parasympathetic nervous system. So just to clarify that, what we're doing is we are activating balance in our system through the release of pleasurable hormones and neurotransmitters. And in doing that, when we feel that release of what I use the acronym DOSE to identify the four commonly known pleasurable hormones, neurotransmitters: dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, and endorphins. When we feel those, when those are activated, we lower the negative bias, the negative looping, the judgmental looping. It settles the mind in a way that redirects and helps us course correct off of some of the negative looping. To be human is to experience negativity or judgment, or maybe someone is in a looping of learned helplessness or depression or panic or anxiety. Whatever looping they are in, whatever patterns are still activating, we can change the wiring in the brain by doing repetitive practices that activate these calming, helpful hormones and neurotransmitters. So that's the good news. As humans, we flip into those places of negativity and resentment or anger or competition, whatever it is. It's what makes us human. It's part of our makeup. And again, the good news is that we know we have neuroplasticity in the brain. We know that we can do practices, mindfulness and meditation practices that in the amygdala, for example, when we're in a high defensive, negative, fearful, stressful process, we know that there are more neural pathways that have been cultivated into the amygdala. We also know through research that doing mindfulness practices and meditation and yoga and so on, we know that they did a study, for example, and over an 8-week period of time, those individuals who practiced meditation and mindfulness techniques reduced the neuronal input into the amygdala. They saw a physical change in the structure and the functioning of the brain and the neural pathways. So that's all the positive that, in terms of, yes, we all have negative patterns. And again, the good news is we can take control of that. We can move from the passenger seat into the driver's seat, and we can learn to put the brake on when we're going too fast. We can learn to put the gas pedal on when we're in a depressive mode and we're stuck and immobilized. So it's about agency, and it's about taking responsibility and being excited about the fact that we can make changes, and we don't always have to go deep, deep into a psychological or emotional investigation. We can impact on our nervous system to create an environment that feels more safe, more calm, and as if we have more agency. And that's the power of these yoga, mindfulness, meditation type interventions.
I think back to the original point of this segment, that's building emotional intelligence.
Yes.
It takes daily awareness, daily insight, daily practices. There's no spiritual bypassing going on there. It's
No.
actually a lot of focus and attention and working on yourself.
It is. And I would want to caution people to not overdo it and maybe even avoid the use of hard work or a lot of attention to things. I honestly would want to pull people off of that languaging because it makes it seem like a chore, like another thing I have to do. Versus what I would want to promote is, what do you want to do to feel good today? When you wake up in the morning, expose your eyes to sunlight, splash cold water on your face. This helps release serotonin in your system. How about if you just do that every day and see how it goes? Or how about if you just, like what I do, one of the things I do every single time I come to a red light, I do what's called micro resting because we have to reset the body throughout the day. We build up a lot of stress in our eyes, our tongue, our jaw, and our shoulders, of course, other places. But when I teach micro resting, those are the three areas that I target: eyes, tongue, and shoulders. So every time I come to a red light, take my hands off the steering wheel, I put them in my lap, and I do micro resting. I relax my eyes and all the muscles. I relax my tongue, my jaw. I open the mouth an eighth of an inch and I release. I drop my shoulders down and I relax. And then I loop through again and again and again till the light turns green. But it's a wonderful reset. And These things become habits, not chores or, an effort. It's for me, because I've done it for so long, it's part of my daily living, just the same like you get up, you brush your teeth, or you whatever people do in the morning. I get up and I already have the awareness because it's been cultivated. Now, that doesn't mean it's perfect by any means. I still am a work in progress in many ways, but I'm grateful that I've developed, as part of my platform, as part of my being, I've developed enough awareness so that I know when I'm off kilter. And sometimes I fall into the rabbit hole, and sometimes I'm successful, like, okay, let's course correct here. This is not helpful for me or anybody else.
Can I tell the audience a secret that
Sure.
Ala and I tried to record this 4 weeks ago, and we were both so off that we forgot to press record.
Yes. Yes.
Now we're back here, and we're both feeling great today. We, of course.
I know, right? And I think this is a better opportunity to really connect and share these beautiful concepts that can help us flourish and thrive and feel better. I mean, that's the bottom line. Humanity as a whole across the entire world is seeking desperately to feel better. We are on a collision course right now with stress, anxiety, depression, feeling just like there is no grounding available. There's no centeredness and harmony. We're off kilter across the entire planet, and we desperately need guidance and help and information on how to do micro moments of peace, micro moments of de-stressing, micro moments of opening the heart.
You talk a little bit about, we're stress in this modern context, and maybe you even talk about this in your new book, which we'll mention in a few minutes. What about the stress of technology and looking at the screens too much and artificial intelligence coming to take over? And do you talk about that at all?
Yes, gosh, it is so pervasive. There's a term now that's being used called techno stress, and it is just massive, massive, pervasive. People are so overwhelmed with constant flooding of things like, oh, you need a new password. You can't get into your bank account anymore because they've closed it because you need a new password every 3 months. Or you've got to sign up. The other day, I went into the government IRS.gov website and I had to go through, it probably took me about 30 minutes to go through so many different levels and layers of setting up an account. So that I could get direct deposit into my account, my bank account. I mean, my God, it's just so, it's everywhere. It's everything and everywhere. And people are constantly forcing you, businesses and so on, are constantly forcing you, go online and do it. There was a situation. I was down at one of the government offices in Charlottesville, Virginia here. This elderly gentleman came in and asked for help at the counter regarding something that he needed to do. And the woman behind the counter, instead of helping him, said to him, go online and set up your account and you'll find the information online. And the gentleman was like, okay, I drove 20 minutes to get down here. I tried to go online and I couldn't figure it out. And I'm coming down here to get help in person because I couldn't do it. And she wasn't very helpful, really, and just sort of, kept pushing, you need to set up your own account. And it was unfortunate. That's techno stress. That's what our world has come to. And not everybody is up to par in how to navigate these things that they're asking us to do. It's constant across the board. It doesn't matter what you're doing. You go to a restaurant, and instead of having a physical menu, you've got to do some kind of QR code with your phone. Not everybody knows how to do that. It's like technology is moving faster than our ability to adapt to it. And it's causing tremendous stress across the board.
And it's not good for our nervous systems either to just be constantly bombarded. But
Right.
it's just like, woo. And even like I've had, what I thought were all of my alarms turned off while I'm on the call, and more just keep coming. So,
Yes.
oh my God,
Yes.
where are they all coming from?
Yeah. Yeah. It's called the attention economy. Businesses are capitalizing, and it's like a tsunami. You cannot go anywhere on things like YouTube or Facebook without a million different menus flipping up in front of you for ads and turning off. Like if you're watching a Netflix movie, it shuts the movie down. So you have like 3 or 4 minutes of ads you have to watch. All of that is stress inducing, and it's subtle. Sometimes we don't even notice it. But after a while, it's catching up to us, and our systems are so compromised. And that's why these techniques and strategies for yoga-based interventions or mindfulness interventions or even just psychology interventions around how do we self-soothe? How do we self-regulate against this onslaught?
Yeah. I've always admired that about you, that you will literally take time off, take time away. I don't know if you still do this, but a few years ago, it's kind of like, well, it's August. I'm taking time off. I'm enjoying myself. I'm going to go to the river. I'm going to play volleyball. I'm going to go camping and hiking. And
Right. Yeah.
an effort to kind of de-link from all of that.
Yeah. Amy, one of my biggest blessings in life, truly, is that I started on my path of yoga way before I went to college, my academic career, my professional career. I had such a beautiful immersion into the yoga practices early on that were spiritually based, that were psychology based. And I just am so grateful that I had that platform established and then moved into my college career, academia, my professional career. And so those years really shaped my thinking and my behavior and my choices. I'm so grateful for that.
That's what I call the yoga is centered. You're coming home to self was the yoga before you layered on the PhD and the academic appointments at wonderful universities and all the kind of more famous things, your time at Yogaville and, continues. But like you have the yoga as the deepest part of who you are inside of all that.
Absolutely. And that's why I'm saying that I'm so grateful. It wasn't layered on top of college, professional, and then I got involved in yoga. It was very much the reverse. And like I said, that's what I'm very grateful for.
Well, it shows.
Oh, thank you. And the same to you, though, too. You've done deep immersion into the spiritual aspects of yoga and the professional aspects of how yoga can be implemented across populations. So, I think we're very similar in that way.
So let's finish up by talking about your new book that you have coming out. Why don't you tell us about it? Because that's really this whole framework of neuro yoga psychology model is really taken to the fullest extent in this book that you've been working on for a couple of years now.
Yeah, thank you so much for asking about that. It feels like it's my magnum opus or something. It's been such a deep dive and pervasively deep dive into the intersection of neuroscience, yoga, and psychology. So the title of the book is actually Neuroscience, Yoga, and Psychology: Tools for Vagus Nerve Regulation for Health and Peak Performance. So basically, I developed a model that integrates yoga, psychology, and neuroscience. It integrates those three fields and gives basically a platform for how do we heal? What are the tools that we can use for healing? What are the tools we can use for peak performance? And it's not just athletic peak performance. It's how can I do my best in my relationship? How can I do my best in parenting or in my job or in business or in healthcare? So peak performance is something that we internally gauge and want to be aware of in terms of, am I doing my best? And do I have job satisfaction? That type of thing. So, bottom line is the book lays out a model based on the Eightfold Path of Yoga, correlates it with psychology, and uses evidence-based neuroscience research on why and how the yoga practices work. So, there's information in the book on the convergence of neuroscience and the Eightfold Path. So I lay out specific tools and techniques and strategies that people can do based, again, on these eight steps and somatic practices that individuals can do. The book is designed across the board for the public, practitioners, yoga therapists, yoga teachers, healthcare workers, and definitely mental health care workers. So it provides, I think, a nice design and paradigm for understanding interventions, and then what can I give my clients or patients or students, or what can I practice, and why it makes sense.
Sounds amazing.
Thank you. And actually, if people are interested, they certainly can pre-order the book on Amazon and other platforms similar to Amazon.
Say the name one more time.
The name of the book is Neuroscience, Yoga, and Psychology: Tools for Vagus Nerve Regulation for Health and Peak Performance.
Thank you, Mala, for being here with me. And it's lovely. And I know I need to get you out the door to your next appointment.
Well, thank you. This has really been delightful, and I'm so happy. Anytime I can spend time with you as my dear friend, I'm happy to do that. So thank you very much. And thank you to all of those individuals out there who might be listening in on this podcast. I certainly appreciate your support and being here with us today.
Thanks so much, Mala. Thank you to Mala for being with us today. It was a lovely way to end the week. And I love that we have a second attempt, that we tried it on Monday. It did not go well. We were both not feeling it. And so we scratched it and we came back and we tried again today. And I found this second attempt to be very energizing, invigorating, full of vitality and prana. And I think it just goes to show that sometimes you just have to try again. Just get right back up when you fail and try again. So have a great week, everybody. Get out there and try something again that you failed at the first time. It's okay. Thanks, everybody. Have a good week. A way that you can help support the Yoga Therapy Hour. Our Optimal State mobile app is available for both Android and iPhone. We've really simplified the check-in process, and it's a way to track your nervous system regulation, as well as your physical health and mental health. It can be part of your personal or professional practice. And by that, what we mean is that you might like to track your own nervous system, mental and physical health, and see the data for yourself, as well as receive interventions, do yoga nidras, breath work, meditation. All of it is on the app, and new content is being added all the time. But a second way you might like to use it is to recommend that your clients, your students, also use the app so that they can show you the data about their nervous system, about their mental and physical health. You can see where they've been in the weeks or months between the times that you meet with them as a practitioner. The app offers structured practices, self-assessment tools, and it's guided and rooted in yoga therapy and nervous system science. It's designed to help you track your state and begin to understand what shifts you and how to choose practices that will bring you back into balance. Whether you're using it for your own well-being or integrating it into the care for others that you offer, we'd love for you to come check it out and do the 3-week free trial. After that, it's about $5 a month. It's a tool that can support you and also the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. Thanks for listening to this small way that you can support the Yoga Therapy Hour. We wish you a wonderful week. We hope that somehow, in a small way, we've contributed to your well-being so that you can go out and share that well-being with others. That's what life is all about, bringing in the goodness through you and then shining it out to the world. We need you more than ever. So let's all get out there, do good, be good, and have a great week.